SQL Down Under is a podcast for professionals working in the SQL Server community. SQL Server is a trademark of Microsoft Corporation. Opinions expressed during the podcast are individual opinions and may not reflect the opinions of SQL Down Under or of Microsoft Corporation. Introducing Show 92 with guest Joey D'Antoni. Joey D'Antoni is an architect and SQL Server MVP with over two decades of experience working in both Fortune 500 and smaller firms. He holds a Bachelor of Science in Computer Information Systems from Louisiana Tech University and an MBA from North Carolina State University. He's a Microsoft Data Platform MVP and a VMware vExpert. Joey's a frequent speaker at PaaS Summit, Ignite, Code Camps, and SQL Saturday events around the world. So welcome, Joey.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks for the lovely introduction.
Indeed. All good. So good to talk to you again.
Yeah.
And so listen, what I get everyone to do first up is tell us, look, how did you ever come to be involved with SQL Server?
Funny story. So I started out in 1996 working as an intern on an Oracle DBA team. And I worked in, for a summer, I worked on Oracle, and there was some SQL Server there that was very early days. I didn't touch it. I only used the Unix systems. The next year, I interned at the same company, and I worked on a performance tuning team. Then I graduated college in 98, and my first real job was on a DBA team, and we adopted SQL Server. We were primarily Oracle, but we started adopting SQL Server, and I learned on SQL Server 7. I had the official Microsoft, or maybe 2000. I don't remember. We had 7. I think I took training on 2000.
7 was a good one to start with. At the time, I was running a software house, and 7 was the first version where I felt comfortable putting it at customer sites.
Yeah, 6.5, I've heard, had corruption issues and stuff.
Not so much that. It just needed a lot of admin in the earlier versions. And I think the thing I liked is that with 7... we'd put it out at customer sites and they would go quiet.
Yeah.
And if you're a software house, quiet is good.
Good. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So I took the 7 training or the 2000 training. I don't remember which, but then I started working with SQL Server, and I've kind of just always worked with SQL Server and Oracle since then. Mostly SQL Server in the last 15 years. But I did actually write the training that Microsoft uses for partners for Oracle. They have... Microsoft, it's weird. Microsoft has Oracle training, so partners can help customers migrate off of Oracle onto SQL Server. And I wrote that with some help from Denny, but it was mostly mine.
Yeah, actually, for many years, I remember quite early on, they had as well SQL Server for Oracle DBAs as well, the other way around. So, I mean, they had quite a bit of Oracle related content at various times over the years.
Yeah.
That's great. And the other one that's coming up today is stuff around Postgres. So how did you get involved with that?
So one of the things that I think was really cool about learning databases via Oracle, in spite of their terribleness as a licensing company, was I learned Unix, right? So I've always...
Actually, before you go any further, I might get you to tell me, what was the move across from Oracle to SQL Server like?
So that was very early days, right? I was pretty young as a DBA, so it didn't bother me. But I can tell you, my team of Oracle DBAs was not really super impressed by SQL Server. I was fairly new, and I liked some of the GUI features. I didn't like in the early days, pre Jeffrey Snover at Microsoft, I didn't like how hard it was to script stuff across servers, and PowerShell has mainly fixed that, and that's a non I'd honestly argue for an enterprise, it's easier to do stuff in PowerShell than it is Bash. And even if you're going cross-platform now. So back to that, I was always working in Unix systems. And when Linux came around and became more acceptable, I worked in Linux a lot. So I got to work with those databases, and kind of in my role when I was principal architect at Comcast Cable here in the States, and I was kind of, we had like another Oracle guy on the team, but I worked with Oracle and SQL and like Hadoop and all those systems, but I also kind of covered MySQL and Postgres because we had a lot of those systems. And
what we say here in Australia, a glutton for punishment.
Yeah. And honestly, the current project I'm working on right now is Postgres. And I sense like one of the things that was kind of interesting at Past Summit this year was Redgate kind of, because they're running it and they have, as far as I can tell, one of the only commercial products that does CI/CD for Postgres with Flyway.
No, it's a good shout out to the Redgate folk, our friends there, because they've been doing a lot of work taking, I think, things that are commonplace in the SQL Server community and looking and going, what's missing in the Postgres community?
Yeah, like we talk about SQL package and we don't love it, but we have it, right? Like it's a way we can easily deploy, and it gives us a framework for how we build source control for database code. And that kind of doesn't exist. Like my repos are all modeled after it if they were SQL package, but I just don't have a tool like that. So right now we're early in the project, so it's not a big deal. We just blow away the database and recreate it. But that's actually something I was spending some time this afternoon. There
comes a point where you can't do that. Yeah.
I was spending some time this afternoon evaluating, some of the solutions that are out there, and was on Redgate's page for that.
Yeah. No, it's really good that they've been sort of adding that sort of tooling. So listen, where do you think the comparison's at the moment? For many, many years, I think the SQL Server team always keeps an eye on the Postgres team all the time. And my concern from the SQL Server point of view is I always used to think it's not whether it's the same, but if it gets to the point of being good enough, then that becomes a threat to anything that has sort of licensing implications. And I think for a few years now, it's got to the good enough stage.
I think as a pure database engine, especially if you consume it as a cloud service, that's kind of the key element there. And I would have pushed back harder against and tried to use SQL Server in this project, but I knew we were always going to deploy it on Amazon RDS. So the two big things that really takes away are the high availability concerns and then the backup and restore concerns, because that's all handled by the cloud provider. And let's kind of dive into that a little bit deeper. High availability on Linux is kind of a mess. This is, in my opinion, this is the reason why SQL Server on Linux hasn't taken off more than it has, because they really didn't think, and I remember when they were building and I was like, what are you going to do for HA? What are you going to do for HA?
Yeah.
And it just never got anywhere. And it was this cobbled together thing where you had to install four or five different packages.
Yeah, it's hard.
I implemented, when I was at DCAC, I implemented MySQL high availability for two or three different customers that wanted it. And none of them actually ended up running with it because they didn't have, like, I got it working and it was like four different Linux packages and they didn't really have good Linux sysadmins. It was like a Windows guy who knew some Linux and they like couldn't figure out how to fail it over. And it was legitimately hard. I had to leave pretty detailed documentation just to get them going. So HA is a big problem. But if you're running in a cloud service, you don't care about that. So that's like a feature. The other aspect is backups. Backups in Postgres and MySQL are basically where they were at like Oracle 7.2, I think SQL Server 6.5, because Oracle SQL 7 had...
I've never understood why it's so complex to...
Yeah, SQL Server 7 had hot backup, right? Like you could just... back up a running database, and it was a dot back file. So I think that was like the start of our current backup architecture. But yeah, it's the only backups are kind of logical backups. And before we were talking pre-show, the project I'm working on, I have this, my build process for my warehouse is pretty elaborate, and I'm ingesting data from some raw files during the build process, at least for right now, until we get real amounts of data, because this is just sample data. So I was going down the path of having to have a separate build process for Windows and Linux. And I was like, that's stupid. So I just, for the only people who are going to be using it on Windows are devs, and they just need to have the database. So it's just like restore backup, Well, as part of the restore instructions, the restore actually throws an error. And it's, I can't remember what the error is. It might have been something related to a table being recreated or a foreign key. And it might be legitimate, but the restore process still works, but it throws an error. So like my instructions in the README file are, restore this, it will throw an error.
If you get this error, please ignore it.
Yeah, check the table.
Go and check something.
So those are the two big gaps. But I have to say, development-wise, if you're running, I would say like in the terms of like system performance, probably 60 to 90th percentile database, you're probably fine. There's a lot of SQL Server has a lot of nice to haves. Like column store indexes are a really nice to have feature. And the only way you can get anything like that in Postgres is to pay a vendor. There are a lot of things you'll run into too, where it's like there's a solution, but you either have to install an extension or maybe pay for an extension that a vendor has written. And I know there are some solutions like that in the AJA and backup space too. Probably that's what's hampered the development of that in the open source community.
Have you found any particular restrictions working with the RDS implementation of?
I haven't done that much with it yet. I know you're limited on the extensions you can use because there's a specific, there's an open source extension called Apache Age that's a graph extension. Microsoft actually made it available on Azure at Ignite. It was one of their announcements around Postgres. That's not currently available on AWS. I suspect it's going to be some things like that. Most of the gotchas in that space tend to be, you know, you're locked into a box. The one thing that's nice about Postgres here, and this goes back to your earlier thoughts about licensing, is to me, one of the big problems with like SQL Server managed or Azure SQL managed instance is like, if you need to increase storage, you need to buy more cores. And because those cores have licenses, it gets exponentially more expensive.
Yeah.
Where in Postgres, you can just scale up for the cost of the hardware. And I think that's where you really see the benefit. And I think the folks that are deploying it on-prem tend to have teams of engineers that can do Postgres things and do things like write extensions. But I think for anybody else who's considering using an open source database like that, they want to look at the cloud vendor because it's just a lot easier. It's really kind of funny how and I'm going to speak to this to the Azure side because I know it's slightly better than the RDS side. If you haven't used the Azure Postgres service, it is the most like infrastructure as a service platform as a service offering, if that makes sense to you. You specify the VM size, you get to pick from, they use standard VMs, so you can just use any VM type that's available in Azure, and you can specify the disk configuration and what kind of disk performance you need. So like that team's done a really good job of being pretty explicit and letting you choose the kind of hardware you want to run on and scale it.
And high availabilities, much better story. Yeah,
so. Yeah, I don't know what they're doing for high availability. I've been working.
Basically, they seem to have bought the Citus people years ago, and
and
then they've gone and done significant work and contributed back into Postgres, I might add.
Yeah.
And I think at the moment they must be easily one of the biggest contributors or committers into Postgres.
Yeah, it's interesting how they can kind of get away with not open sourcing some of those features though, because they built the query store for Postgres, but it's not open source.
Yeah.
That's another example. Now that I'm thinking about that, that's another example of something that's a little bit trickier. I was trying to trace some SQL coming in, and there's not a tool like Profiler. Like you kind of have to go edit the system config of your database, and maybe somebody smarter than me knows this trick, or knows a better trick, but I looked, and the only way I was finding people saying you could like attach dtrace to the process, which seemed not like what I wanted to do.
And again, that's a level of complexity that you really shouldn't be needing to do. And presuming requires permissions that are very substantial in the database engine as well. Oh, sorry, in the server as well.
Yeah, it was, and that's where you really feel a lot of the rough edges, right? Like it's not in the database engine itself. Although the programming language I would argue is what PGSQL. PGSQL, thank you. I can remember. There are some limitations there. Like it's, it's hard to do looping or conditional.
Yeah, actually, I was going to ask you what your feeling was about the state of the language between the two.
Yeah, it's T-SQL's finally starting to catch up. Like Microsoft finally, I think in last year they announced they're doing JSON and more JSON and regex in Azure SQL. Presumably that will be coming to 2025. I can't imagine there's anything that's like in Azure now that's not going to go to 2025.
Well, that's right. I mean, the fact that those things are, it's one of the things I love about working with Azure SQL Database all the time is that I'm already able to use those things.
The one place Postgres has, and it's extension you have to add, but I know this from a customer, because one of my customers is a real estate data firm, and they still use Postgres for a lot of like shape kind of data. Basically they say it's a lot faster than SQL Server at doing those kind of operations.
That would not surprise me at all.
They're pretty well versed.
A lot of the graph style extensions and things, I think, are far richer as well.
Yeah, that Apache Age extension is pretty cool. It would be nice to see Microsoft maybe implement some of that functionality, or I don't know if there's a way they can implement something that's written for Postgres in a SQL Server, but I think it's all part of ANSI 92 SQL too as well.
Yeah, I must admit the graph support that came in SQL Server 2017, I was not a fan of. I understand why they would probably marketing-wise have wanted to have it there, but I look at the support and to me, you've got some real challenges there. And I think at the moment, I don't know if you have any, but I haven't seen a single person using it in anger ever since. And that means it adds quite a lot of baggage to the product that has to be maintained.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that anybody's actually using it.
I feel like that's one of those features that got kind of hurt by the telemetry-driven development process that Microsoft has now, because they released it probably before it was ready. Like, they added some features in 2019. I think it was 2019. It may have been 2022. That made it a little bit more practical. Like, I think longest path or shortest path stuff was available. And to me, that was like table stakes for that feature. That stuff needed to be there to start with. And because of that...
One of the biggest problems with the graph stuff, though, is that it's had to be layered over the top of T-SQL, and T-SQL stops you doing a whole lot of things that you'd want to do with a graph thing. So, for example, if I had a people and, what are they like? And it could be restaurants and it could be, movie theaters and it could be all sorts of different things. The problem is I can't easily in SQL Server deal with the sort of polymorphism thing where I can say, look, let me call a thing and then return objects of different types, and so on. And that's the sort of stuff you can do in graph.
And you can see with that, like where that plays in nicely with Postgres and the extension model, right? Because like you can write an extension that builds all that stuff, and it's not exactly the same thing as changing the core engine code. And having talked to UC a lot about how hard it is just to add something that's like syntactical sugar, is very difficult in SQL Server just because of the language base and the process. And that's where having something that could be more modular, like an extension, could be really useful.
Oh, yeah. Look, I think one of the things that I really still miss in T-SQL is the fact that I can't implement things like the ones that are there in the system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's a simple example. If I wanted to, build a divide function that takes any numeric types for two parameters and returns back a value, I can't build, something that if the inputs are both ints, returns an int or returns something different if it's decimal. And so there's no way I can build those sort of things, right? Even if we at least had operator overloading or parameter overloading, where at least, I could write different versions of the function for different input parameter types or something, I could start to get around that sort of thing. But I mean, it's very, very difficult. I look at the new date functions that were recently added. And again, they return different data types depending upon the input data types. Now, I can't build anything that's like that.
Yeah, yeah. It would be nice to have some of those system abilities. I always wonder when stuff like that isn't surfaced, if there's something weird and unsecure about the way it was implemented in the first place.
Yeah, it's the same thing with inheritance. You know, I've always thought some form of inheritance is the sort of thing that might appeal to developers there as well, right? I mean, so if I had a salesperson table that's derived from an employee table, you know, I wish I could write a query that, you know, asked for an employee and I could pass a salesperson to it, you know, and so on and so on. You know, there's so many of these things. And it's one of the differences with Postgres is they always described it as an object relational database management system, a bit more than just a relational database management system.
Yeah, have you, back to Graph for a second, have you worked with any devs who really struggled to understand that concept? Because
Very much so.
Yeah, it's something, because we have, in this project, we kind of have a potential natural use case for it with supply chain information. And the devs I'm working on, I think they get it now, but they really struggled to kind of just understand the concept of a graph.
But see, even with the graph stuff, I don't like the syntax, because again, even the join syntax, they've gone back to a pre-ANSI 92 style join syntax that they've put in there. And I look at that and go, surely there's a way we could have avoided that. That I struggle with. But even then, when they have the matching syntax and so on, if you look at the sort of things you can do in Neo4j or these other sort of engines, you can do much more than that.
Yeah.
You know, so I can say, you know, which restaurants am I interested in? But I could have, for example, a star rating and I could return, give me the ones where, you know, I've actually given them at least 4 stars, you know, and so on. And but part of the connection, or, you know, from the person to the restaurant can include things like a rating or things to filter on and so on. Like there's just a richness in some of those other languages that just isn't there.
Yeah, and it was probably never going to be possible in SQL, even if they dedicated. Oh, look,
I haven't seen anybody working on Graph in a long time, and everybody that I know that was in that team seems to either not be there or they're working on something else.
So. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so maybe what we need in Fabric is a Graph. since they seem to be reinventing everything else in Fabric.
Yeah, it is funny you say that. It's one of the things that I am critical of at the moment is that instead of moving a lot of these things forward, we seem to be just endlessly reinventing the same thing. And
I have a bicycle wheel behind me, as you can probably see. And I always joke that because there's with some of the stuff with Fabric, like Data Factory and even to a lesser extent, SQL Database and like a couple of other things. It's like, yeah, we need one of those round things with spokes. What do we call that? let's build it.
Yeah, it does worry me because I look at, say, Azure Data Factory, and it's got to a fairly mature stage. Mm-hmm. And then we had Synapse pipelines that were nowhere near what was in Azure Data Factory. And now we've got Fabric Data Factory, which is still a subset of what was in Azure Data Factory. And just go, well, like, if instead we had just kept moving forward, where would we be instead of rewriting it and not even getting back to where we started?
The other thing that frustrates me there a little bit is just they've built so much really nice stuff in Azure and they don't incorporate, like, they're not leveraging that in Fabric. And that's the part that's frustrating.
Yeah, indeed. You see all the discussion, people online saying, how do we deal with identity and all those.
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing is, all those things are already there in Azure.
Yeah.
But I think part of it is because they're building it as a software as a service application. Yeah. And they think, well, we have to build all of those things again inside it because we can't expect that somebody can go out.
I really question the notion of a data engineering platform ever being software as a service, because it's just got so many complexities. Yeah, it's an interesting.
Look, I mean, many of the things, it's kind of good. Where it sort of maintains things easily. But I look at, for example, Fabric SQL Database, and my first question is, why does it exist?
Yeah. Right?
Now, it's a little bit different now because I think the because of the way that, again, the licensing works in, mm-hmm. in terms of that. But if you look at what can I do in Fabric SQL Database that I can't do in Azure SQL Database, the answer is nothing, right? And so
yeah.
then well, you've well, just got there's to say, like well, that one why page, does it exist?
There's a docs page where it says you can do cross-database queries. And I was like, wait, what? And then it's like, no, you can make cross-database query calls to the Fabric SQL endpoint. So it's not truly cross-database queries. And I was like, oh, okay, never mind. It's nothing.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, so look, a shout out to David Murray and team and the guys there. I've been really happy to see the focus that the SQL Server team has put back into doing work to do things that interest developers.
Yeah, for sure. And that's it's something I see like on Reddit and stuff sometimes. I think one of the things that's hurting probably both SQL Server and Oracle is a lot of university developers are learning on Postgres, right? Like that's
100%. Yep.
And I can, this NDA is probably over now, so it's probably safe for me to say that this was one of the main reasons why Microsoft pursued SQL Server on Linux. It wasn't that they thought they were going to capture a large portion of the commercial market. They were really hoping to capture more of the university market. And I don't think that's happened. I do find it interesting, and this is kind of to tie it back to the two databases. It's still cheaper to run SQL Azure on lower tiers than it is to run Postgres in Azure, which I've always found kind of interesting. The like low S tier, so it's the tiers I'm referring to are S0 and basic, and I think
the bottom S1, of the DTU ones.
S1.
I must admit, I don't tend to use S0 and S1 much. And it's mostly because the scaling doesn't work very well once you're on those. So, I mean, if you're anywhere between S2 and S12, you can just scale up or down as a metadata operation. But
yeah, there's storage. It's a different story.
Yeah, 0 or 1, it actually copies the whole database.
You know? Yeah. And, I have a little app that I run on an S0. Except when I do, and it's an app that I ingest all of the Azure VM data from all over the world, like what's available, and I run that weekly. And so all I do there, but it's a small database, so I have in an automation run book, I resize it to a P4, I do my data ingestion, and then resize it back to an S0. And it runs fine.
Look, we do it all the time, moving them up and down, because the... Yeah, we're often running loading phases for BI projects and things like that. And yeah, I want it to run quick while it's happening, but I don't want it running like that the whole rest of the day, you know?
Yeah, and I do find it interesting that Microsoft has kept those SKUs around, and the costs are really, really low on them. And you can get cheaper. The Postgres stuff has gotten cheaper. There are like B-series SKUs available.
Originally, it had another SKU, though, where it was very competitive with the bottom-end ones, but they got rid of that. So
I think, let me look at my portal, because I have one handy. I think the cheapest one's about $16 a month.
Yeah.
U.S., that sound about right?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the cheapest SQL one's 5. So it's not a huge difference, but it is still 3x more, which, yeah.
Hi, this is Greg. Just wanted to thank you for listening to this show and let you know that if you'd like to let me teach you more about SQL Server, we now have both free courses and low-cost courses available online and on demand. The courses include detailed hands-on lab work for you to complete to reinforce your learning, and there are more courses coming in the next few months. You'll find details at training.sqldownunder.com. No, that's actually good. So development-wise, you haven't found a huge difference there in that sort of regard. What about the fact that in Postgres you have an option on extending with other languages and things? Is that anything you use?
I haven't used it. I think notionally it's a good concept. Like Oracle's kind of always had that too. Like, because you could, and they've tended to be languages that Larry Ellison wanted to buy. But like Java, you've always been able to do Java. But I haven't. I think it's based on my experiences doing SQL development in Postgres. I can see where you would want to use an external language because the just because 100%. The surface area, the surface area of the SQL language is kind of limited. But at the same time, it scares me a little bit because I also think about how like unsecure CLR is from a...
Yeah, see, even that, it's interesting. We had the only real way to extend things was SQL CLR. And nowadays, I don't use that simply because it doesn't work in all the different environments that I want to work in.
It's pretty much on...
That's a problem.
Yeah, it's on, I think, like every audit specification to turn it off. Except that you have to have it for SSIS DB, which is still kind of funny.
It's interesting you mention the audit specs and things, though. The requirements, one of the ones that drives me crazy is that they always suggest turning off SQL logins, yet a lot of the tooling from the BI teams, and including Fabric and so on, give you no option but to use SQL logins.
Right. Yeah,
and that's frustrating. I've been trying to get. I mean, a good example is if you have Azure Analysis Services, you can add a managed identity to it, but you can't
use it for anything. It's funny. It's funny you mentioned that because somebody asked me about that a few weeks ago. Because that service, I haven't seen that service in use in a while.
We've got lots of customers using it simply because for licensing, you know, there are many, many customers for whom the licensing is just far superior when they're in Azure Analysis.
Yeah, I guess if you're on a smaller SKU, because it gets pretty expensive pretty fast. That was the thing I ran into. But
actually, the biggest limitation with it is that it didn't follow into the Gen 2 stuff with how they manage memory. And I think Azure Analysis Services, the challenge there is that you've got to be very, very careful about the amount of memory you're using in the models.
For sure.
But we also have to do things like time when we do refreshes of multiple models and all those sort of things to avoid simply running out of memory.
I built like the most elaborate quirky automation system for starting and stopping analysis services because we had a customer that they had a customer who they were basically selling data to in the form of an analysis services cube, and they told the customer how much it was going to cost, you know, if the cube ran all the time, because their model was pretty big and it needed 64 gig of memory. Or actually, I think the SKU has like 58 or something odd. It's a weird number. So they had to, the cost on the SKU was like $5,000 a month. So they were going to have to charge this customer like $20,000 a month. And they were like, well, what if we only turned it on when we needed it? And I'm like, okay, how can we do that? So I have a logic app, which is hooked to an Outlook email box. The customer and the managers at the company could send an email to this. And if the title of the email was cube on, it would kick off an automation runbook that started the cube. And then they were instructed to send another email that said cube off. But if they didn't, it would just shut off at 8 o'clock every day.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous, but I couldn't think of another way to do it without giving the customer access.
Yeah, there's a few weird things. We have one customer where they have a logic app and that in the end they end up exposing a button in Power BI that ends up firing a logic app that ends up refreshing a partition of a cube and so on. And but even just to build that, I mean, there's a lot of messing around to do things like, you know, if there isn't already a refresh running and so on to get that sort of logic all working perfectly.
Yeah.
That's good.
Cool.
Look, do you think that's one of the big limitations in the Postgres side of things is the fact that the other sort of services are not just in the box and, you know, part of what's supplied?
I think that's a good question. I think that's something that has faded over time, right? Because I think probably 10, 15 years ago, we had a lot more customers using analysis services, integration services,
and reporting services.
Now, the only one of those services I'm going to say I commonly see in use is SSIS. Like, I rarely see SSRS. Where I tend to see SSRS is smaller shops that have like one or, you know, an ERP system, and that's about it. And they'll run it in lieu of something like Power BI. SSIS is really the only thing I see broadly used. I know SSRS is deployed everywhere, but I've always joked that Microsoft should make SQL Server 2008 reporting services a platform as a service offering, because all the customers who would want to adopt that are still like on 2008.
That's right, because nothing has sort of changed since. And the I think reporting services... still had a perfect place. There's lots of people who still want standard reports and things.
Lots of small orgs still use it, but I don't see it as often anymore. And SSAS has largely been kind of phased out by Power BI, I'd say. Like,
now, where I see analysis services still is in sites where they don't want the data from their semantic models to be off-premises.
Yeah, that makes sense. But yeah, so that's the... That I think that benefit of Microsoft having all those additional services has gone down over time. So like it's less of a benefit than it was. And I think the one place I really feel the gap between the two is just the tooling around the databases, like source control, SQL package isn't perfect, but there isn't a thing that is like SQL package that exists for Postgres unless you go to third party or complexity, tracing code, those sorts of things, nothing like Profiler. Those are all the kind of, it's still rougher around the edges, and that's can be challenging. And it depends on the nature of the organization. If the organization has the engineers who are comfortable supporting it, that's going to work. If you're just trying to take some...
Which is an interesting trade-off, right?
Yeah, you're right.
Which is saying, I don't want to pay for licenses, but in the end, I'll end up paying for people.
Yeah people tend to cost more than licenses even. Yeah. I mean, there's a point at which, right, like you, and I think anybody who's ever worked in a large enterprise, a very large enterprise, or worked on a very big system can see where you might want to go to an open source database, because the licensing costs for some of these systems can get massive, especially when you have multiple nodes and you know, they're all big core counts. But at the same time, you know, writing a check to Microsoft for $1 million and then subsequently $250,000 a year, that's a lot, but that's still, you know, one engineer a year.
Right. Like, you're talking about a handful of people. And so, it is that is still a trade-off. I think the other thing is that a lot of customers still like having, in theory, at least, you know, one person they can yell at. You know?
Yeah.
And I think in some of the open source areas, they're concerned that they just don't have that.
Yeah, and Postgres has, it's always interesting when customers do that, because like there's like I shouldn't know this off the top of my head, but I can't remember the name of the main Postgres vendor.
EDB?
EDB, there's one other one too. But like every time I've gone to a customer that's wanted to implement an open source database, they're like, no, we're not paying for support. And it's like, okay. Back to that like high availability thing we were talking about. Every time I've like with MySQL, there's a high availability solution that Oracle has, and you can pay for it. And I haven't used it because none of my customers have paid for it. Presumably, it works a lot better than five open source packages to make something highly available. So I think it's important to be aware if you're making a decision around this. You know. It's not going to be all smooth sailing. It's not just as simple as cutting over your databases.
Yeah. Have you had any projects where they're actually migrating code between the two?
I've heard a lot about it, but I haven't actually seen that many. Monica was at a client where they were talking about doing it, and it was a big core business system that was running on SQL Server, and they made some really poor decisions, right? It was like their core business system, and in an effort to reduce manpower cost, they moved it off of VMs and onto RDS SQL Server, one of the things I know we talked about how good platform as a service offerings are for Postgres, But to me, it's always kind of a poor decision if something is really a core business system to move that into a platform as a service offering, just because your hands are a little bit more tied, your scaling options aren't what they might be. And yeah, it costs them a lot more. And one of the things with RDS, they couldn't that you can't run Developer Edition on RDS. So they had to like license all their test systems, which to me that probably ate up all the cost savings that they had. But anyway, so they're trying, because of the cost now, they're trying to migrate to Postgres. But you know, it's so difficult because you have this deep, deep code base and it's all in T-SQL, and it's not, I'm sh not everybody is good about writing like a single data access layer. So typically you'll have some weird mix of stored procedures and queries that are embedded in source code, all across your project.
Bunches of dynamic code.
And all that stuff is different. It's not as simple. I mean, the AI tools are actually kind of good at some of that stuff, but it's never easy. I did a white paper for Quest about this a couple of months ago, because they own one of the database architecture tools now. I can't remember which one. But yeah, and that was kind of the topic of it. And it's like, it's really hard to do this. So and these are the people who they think the market is that, like, of people buying these, because those architecture tools are still pretty expensive. And they think that market is people
Look,
who.
another approach I've seen people trying to take too is to build emulation layers over the top of Postgres. And so I can't remember, there's a one that's been kicking around now on Amazon for a while, which is basically a SQL Server emulation layer that lets you run SQL Server commands and things over the top of Postgres.
And that's Babel. I think that's Babelfish. Yeah,
Yeah, I think
yeah,
so.
yeah.
But I must admit, when I read through the list of limitations, I thought, oh my goodness.
And I know Microsoft has something like that on Cosmos DB for Mongo, right? Like they have a Mongo API that you can use. But yeah, it's I think it's a it's
Actually,
much
it's a stronger one because it actually effectively starts with very similar code. And the thing I like with it is that they run all the Mongo tests and verification things and all against their code, you know. So it's actually at a pretty good state. In fact, I think the Cosmos team is determined to out
Yeah, that's cool.
Mongo. So that's great. So listen, that pretty much brings us to time, Joey. And is there anywhere people will see you coming up or?
Coming up, I'm speaking in Atlanta in a couple of weeks at their user group, and then I'm going to be speaking at FabCon in Vegas in April.
So what are you speaking about at FabCon?
Actually, I'm doing the same talk at both places. It's a talk on building kind of data marts in Fabric SQL database. So like it's kind of aimed at customers who probably don't have enough volume to or skill sets to deal with lakehouses or the data warehouse model. And they just want to get started with understanding what a dimensional model is, taking advantages of features like compression.
Or they want to use a richer development surface.
Don't get me started. But if you want to be able to use Management Studio to write your code. But yeah.
That's
So
great. Well,
cool.
listen, thank you so much for being involved today.
No problem. Thanks, Greg.